Mornings begin here with a ruse simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. And, of course, we want to thank you for joining us at the kitchen table today. I'd like to welcome Michelle Yark, our executive producer. How are you doing, Miss Yark?
I am very well. Thank you for asking. And you?
Good. Had a pretty good week, huh?
Yeah, been busy.
A lot of exciting things happening in your life, huh?
Always.
Huh?
Little oral surgery.
Well, that's always very exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, Slama, did you hear what Michelle said? Things are exciting in her life. She's having oral surgery and she's getting ready for class. I was thinking more like maybe a trip to Paris or something.
I sure would welcome a trip to Paris.
Instead of. Anyway, and across the glass wall, of course, we have our engineer, Dean Slama. How are you doing today?
Hey, y'all.
That studio's coming together in there?
Yeah, it's been wild in here for sure.
Well, anyway, I'm glad that things are coming together in there pretty good. You know?
Yeah, you see the logo we have on the wall, huh?
Yeah, I see the logo.
Look at us representing.
Representing well there.
John, how are you?
I'm doing fine today. I've been a little bit kind of under the weather a little bit. You know, I've been on airplanes a lot lately. You and I went to Israel.
Yes, that was a fabulous trip. We're going to be talking about that in the next 2 weeks or so.
Yeah, that's great. Because I mean, what a fabulous trip that was. And then I went out to do this unbelievable conference in Scottsdale, Arizona. Mm-hmm. Went in to do the Legatus conference. I did food for about 500 good folks and out there. Brought Louisiana food to an international conference of Legatus out there. Mm-hmm. And then you were with me in New York. We went and knocked out that little Today Show.
John was on the Today Show. It was actually on Mardi Gras Day. Let me sum it up this way. He happened to be on air the same day as the Sports Illustrated swimsuit models were there.
No.
Yeah.
So, you know. What?
And I got so sick and tired of them wanting to take pictures with me. You cannot believe it. I lucked up. I mean, here's beautiful Sports Illustrated swimsuit models. But, you know, they're a little tall for me, you know.
Yeah, and they were barefoot.
Well, at 6'3", they're a little tall for me, you know what I mean?
Hey, I see that you have a little sparkly on the table over there. A new little toy, it seems.
Oh.
You've been shopping?
Yes, I have. I'm glad you noticed it. I can't deny it. I cannot walk into any of these shops. This right here, what you see here, is a little plum that I pull off of the mm-hmm. tree.
A little plum.
On Charter Street in New Orleans. You mm-hmm. know what I mean?
I know. Every now and then, a new little object appears in the office. It may be on the conference room table, today on the kitchen table here in the studio, maybe on my desk.
I have to admit, I'm an addict.
You're an addict.
I'm a culinary antique addict, and I have been for 30 years. You know my favorite shop in New Orleans, Lucullus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lucullus is right on the corner there, right down about a block or so from the cathedral on Charter Street. And every time I walk in there, I feel like a kid, you know, kind of in a candy mm-hmm. store. I get the same sensation as I got as an 8-year-old walking into Mr. Barris's store, you know, mm-hmm. in St. James when I went by some kits and some little chocolate kisses. Same thing.
And what makes it worse is that now you're in New Orleans. You know, used to be John might be in New Orleans, you know, might be once a month, but he was in and out fairly quickly. Well, now he has a restaurant in New Orleans, which means, and he's down there quite a lot.
Yeah, every now and then, yeah.
And sometimes I've wondered, why is he going down so early today? And sometimes he says, I have meetings.
I meet.
And it's finally occurred to me that the meetings are with Patrick Dunn from Lucullus.
You know, I can't help myself, Michelle. I mean, Lucullus is, as all of these culinary antique spots I have around the world, Lucullus just happens to be my local port of call, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah, Lucullus is a treasure trove of culinary antiques. And I mean, you know, who can have too many spit roasters from the 1700 clock wound rotisseries that you put in front of your fireplace and there's a goose turning or a leg of pork or something? Or how many copper pans do you really need?
And obviously, Michelle, innumerable.
Michelle, was I supposed to just walk away from that triangular shaped turbo fish pan that I found? I mean, I've never seen one before and I just found it so interesting. But I find that each piece, whether it's a little cast cast iron pot or an early little iron trivet that you put a pot on the fireplace, to those elegant, you know, those beautiful sterling powdered sugar shakers, mm-hmm, or those mm-hmm. copper and brass cleavers that you and I brought back from London, remember, mm-hmm. huh?
Yeah, well, at your local port of call there.
Yeah, my local port of call outside of London at Hungerford, at Below Stairs Antiques in Hungerford. Michelle, every piece has its own beauty, its own culinary history, so
to speak. I know. And as you walk through our hallways and offices, it's truly a feast for the eyes. We've, in fact, had to expand the collection to other locations.
Yeah, well, I mean, it happened.
Know? But, you know, that's one of my first memories of walking into this office so many years ago when I came to interview, were all of the stoves in the hallway. There was a white chamber stove. There was that little blue, I don't even know where that blue stove has found its home right now. You must have had like five stoves lining the hallway.
That's right. That was just some of my spectacular pieces. Mm-hmm. The other less spectacular pieces were in the warehouse.
So I have learned.
I am a stove collector. No doubt. You know, the earliest cooking, I mean, let's face it, I mean, you know, back when great mamma and great papa were cooking, they were cooking over an open fire in a fireplace or a hearth. Mm-hmm. As they call it, you know. And
he's got a twinkle in his eye when he says
and
that.
And I love open hearth cooking.
I know.
And needless to say, I have a few hearth cooking implements, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, at Below Stairs, where you and I went in mm-hmm. Hungerford mm-hmm. outside of London, I bought about 20 years ago a Haesner from 1750, a Haesner, a clock wound apparatus that you pushed up in front of the fireplace, and it was rounded in the back. It kind of looked like an old coffin. There was a trap door you opened up to baste the meat. And I thought to myself, how will I get this to America? And I did, and it's one of my important pieces. But I have a few, you know, these hearth cooking implements. And as you can imagine, cooking over an open hearth presents, you know, some heat regulation issues. You know, I mean, you got to keep the coals going. You got to keep mm-hmm. the heat going. You know what I mean. You need special
tools, of course. And I understand that, you know, I mean, foods need to boil as well as simmer. And, you know, you
That's
have to
right.
have some different things. The adjustable iron pot hook
yep.
allowed for this by the turn yeah, of a crank. And I know you have a couple.
I absolutely love it. In fact, I just was lucky enough to add another one to my collection.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful, huh?
Uh-huh. Did you know that the French used a phrase, hang the pot hook?
Yeah.
When they were throwing
padre.
A housewarming party.
Yeah, they were throwing party. A housewarming party.
So this must be like if you moved into a new house, you got a pot hook.
Exactly right. I mean, absolutely. It's what you did. You hung the hook in the fireplace to show hospitality, and you were ready to feed. That's exactly right. The first stoves, y'all, were these fairly simple iron boxes. I guess the easiest thing to relate it to would be a potbelly stove.
Yeah.
That you see in a camp or something like that, or in a train station
That's
that
right.
you got around to warm. And of course, as the iron heated, fired by coal or wood, you could put a pot on top of it. And you got to think about it. It wasn't until almost, let's face it, the late 1800s, even the early 1900s, that we started to see stoves replacing the open hearth or the hearth stoves. You know.
And I can imagine that a lot of cooks were kind of reluctant to switch. And in fact, I think you have in your home kitchen, you have a stove that kind of do both. I mean, you can cook and you can also still have wood in it.
Yeah, well, I want you to think about when the microwave came out. A lot of people were skeptical about making a change to a new cooking technique. In the early days, I have a stove that was built in 1890, a very rare piece. It's called a combi range. And half of it is wood. And the other half was gas to try to entice the housewife of the day, in fact, who did all the cooking. That gas was easier than hauling wet wood into the house. And that stove also was the first stove ever to use Corning glass in the door of the oven so you could look in. So, that's a perfect example.
In fact, many said that the iron stove allowed you to cook acceptably, but not divinely.
Well, that's exactly right. They were skeptical of it because the smoke of the fires really gave the meat and the foods a better flavor. And we as Louisianians know in order to cook divinely, of course, you need spices, and much to do has been made over, and I have a good collection of condiment holders, you know, mm-hmm. which is also very interesting for salt and things like that. But it was the desire for salt that enticed the Romans to Palestine and the Dead Sea, and that changed the direction of history and religion, all because they needed salt.
But what's interesting is that since then, there are special containers that are crafted just to hold salt. And I've seen these numerous times and thought, I wonder why they have that. But they're square-shaped trenchers, small little-footed cauldrons,
salt cellars,
and they're all made of like precious metals or porcelain or glass, and they have those tiny little spoons to sprinkle the salt over the food.
Salt was too coarse, you know, in hydrous for shakers. You couldn't shake it. That was better suited for sugar. So these beautiful silver powdered sugar casters are some of the most beautiful table pieces that come to us from the past. You can just picture one sitting alongside a plate of beignets on a tablecloth with beautiful mm-hmm. linen and lace, elaborate, deep bowled sugar spoons were carved and pierced that you could actually dip into these bowls and scatter the crushed sugar over foods rather than shake it like powdered sugar. When lump sugars were served, of course, you've seen some of my sugar snippers, which are like these very decorative scissors that chop the sugar, you know, into chunks mm-hmm. in coffee.
Speaking of coffee, a couple of years ago, probably a decade now, I remember that you went absolutely hog wild over enamel coffee pots.
Oh, every color in the rainbow.
Every color in the rainbow. We've got some here in the studio. And what's interesting is that many, many Louisianians seem to have these simple enamel coffee pots in their homes. They swear by them, and they are honestly family heirloom. Still make their coffee in
them. Oh, no, and they're really beautiful, beautiful stuff. Well, you know, there's all kind of beautiful things, y'all. Serving pieces used for seafood, oyster plates. I mean, beautiful salve and Menton and Limoges created all these beautiful half shells and with these beautiful silver three-tined forks, these Majolica designs, striking with their rich marine colors and all of these things. Y'all, we could go on and on and on about stoves and serving pieces and salt shakers and sugar, and we will. You don't want to miss it because it's part of our collection. We'll talk to you a little bit about it, and we have a great guest, so we're going to be back in a minute.
Move to KRVS every Sunday night for 2 hours of hardcore classic Rasta reggae radio right here on Jamon. Jamon, Sunday nights 9 to 11 p.m., Saturday mornings 1 to 3 here on KRVS, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Hey, this is Slade Cleaves, inviting you to visit E-Town this week. I'll be joined by Nick and Helen, and Dar Williams, and the winner of the E-Achievement Award. That's this week in E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
There's a car, truck, or boat taking up space at your house, and you're finally ready to do something about it, KRVS just might be the answer. Your vehicle could be used to support public radio in our community through KRVS's car donation program. One phone call is all it takes. Whether it's running or not, we'll come and get the vehicle, send you a tax receipt when it sells, and you just supported KRVS. Call us now at 877-KRVS-887 or visit our website at krvs.org to learn more. And thanks.
KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
everybody. Welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. It's so nice and cultural show, I might mention.
Absolutely, Michelle, especially today.
No, especially today. Michelle, we're talking about all these magnificent serving pieces that you seem to be making light of my love of these pieces, which I know you're not. But anyway,
I like to harass you, but they are beautiful pieces.
Do you remember the time that I was in Amsterdam and I ran into this little shop and there was this magnificent, I think it was Limoges, it may have been Sèvres, but it was these magnificent fish platters in the window, these narrow, elongated platters rimmed in 24-karat gold, hand-painted with these magnificent fish and marine scenes, and accompanied by serving plates, of course, and there were some silver serving pieces that went with it, and I was paralyzed at the window. So what I did, I went in and I talked to the shopkeeper in Amsterdam, right on the river there. Mm-hmm. And I said, I have to have them. And he said, but sir, how are you going to get them back? I said, I don't know, but I have to have them. So I took them, and I had a friend with me, and we carried this plate and these platters, this beautiful platter, heavy as could be, all through, you know, the rest of our trip in Amsterdam. Then we flew to London. I carried it there. Then eventually to America. About 3 weeks later, I'm walking down Charter Street. There's the same ones in Lucullus. I got a bottle right there.
I hope you didn't tell Henry Shakespeare that, because I know who had the load.
And it was these beautiful fish platters right there at Lucullus. And I said, I have carried these things halfway across the world. I don't do that anymore, I assure you.
Yeah, you do. What are you talking about?
Anyway, y'all, I am in love with my collection, as I say, as you well know.
Yes.
But anyway, we have a great guest with us today talking about Lucullus.
We do, talking about Lucullus. We have our friend and favorite shop owner, our favorite culinary antique collector, our favorite Southern gentleman.
Well, hold on. He has put a spell on me. You know the old spells of New Orleans. I think I can see a little John Falls doll in his back room, and every now and then when a new, like a new poissonniere comes in, he says, this is for John. And then I'm drawn to the
Well, Patrick Dunn of Lucullus Antiques is here with us on the radio show today. Patrick has been researching and collecting the arts and antiques of the culinary world for years. It's a life work. He is a sixth generation Southerner. He is a graduate of Georgetown University. And I have only recently learned that he is a PhD in cultural history from Tulane. So we should be addressing him as Dr. Patrick Dunn.
That's right.
He writes Epicurean articles in magazines, especially Southern Accents. And he is the author of The Epicurean Collector.
Beautiful
book. One of our favorite books. And Patrick is here to tell us more about the fascinating world of culinary antiques.
And design, I should remember we learned that.
Yeah, and design. We're going to talk about that.
Oh, my God. I didn't know he kept that under his hat. I knew you was a designer. I knew it. Patrick, how are you doing?
Good morning, Jeff. How are you?
We're doing really good. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Patrick, we've been talking about going into your shop and how I'm always I learned so much in there from you, and we both leave spellbound, and of course John leaves with a little tote bag of goodies.
We hope it's not a little bag.
Often it's not. Often we have to pull the car around. But tell us how you got interested in antiques and in food, and how you came to put those together.
Well, I think I've told the chef this, but my father was a country judge, and he knew the best place to eat every little thing. I mean, it wasn't fancy restaurants like Revolution, but it was the best place that was apple pie or chili or whatever. And he was a great antique collector. He started collecting things from his family's past at auctions, and I, as a little boy, I'd have to sit there through auctions. I hate them to this day, because I'm like the chef. I don't like not to get something I want, and he could manage to do it. So I guess I absorbed it from my father, because he really knew both worlds. He was really a gourmand, and I guess what you would call a locavore today, because he knew the best product of the country. So I've been thinking about this recently, and as a little boy, I just absorbed both of these things. And then one day, sitting at Galatoire's, where everything happens, I had the notion that New Orleans had antique stores and had restaurants. Why not put them together?
And there you go.
That absolutely made a lot of sense. You know, I've been shopping at Lucullus for years, and I know that you were there many years before that. First of all, how long have you been in business? And I want our listeners to know exactly where the shop is located and a little bit about it. Patrick, can you tell us that?
Well, of course, we're on Charter Street, 610 Charter Street, between Toulouse and the Square. Not far from where the Great Fire started at the end of the 18th century, and we've been in business about 30 years.
Patrick, when you started your business, did people really kind of understand what you were really doing? I mean, it's very unique.
Well, you know, I had a few friends among the older antique dealers, because before I started the store, I was a buyer myself. I'd go up and down the streets of the French Quarter, you know, with my little pittance and buying things here and there. But when I started, I'll never forget several of the older and big antique stores on Royal Street came over, and they shook their head and they told me, you know, it's a great idea, boy, but there just isn't enough stuff about food in the antique world. So I sort of put that chip on my shoulder, and when I went off on my first buying trip, I thought, well, maybe this is crazy. Maybe there's not enough stuff. I quickly learned that outside of worshiping God, I don't think the human being has devoted more energy and artistic effort to anything more than food. And believe me, there was more than enough.
Well, you know, that's such a great point you make right there, because, I mean, if you look at man's constant interest in something, what's it going to be? It's going to be family. It's going to be their workplace. It's certainly going to all revolve around food and serving it at the table, no matter how simplistic or how elaborate. So, yeah, absolutely. I can imagine that people would say, well, what do you want to do that for? But yet, at the same time, probably one of the most interesting careers. I envy you, let me say that, Patrick, that you were able to conceive it and then make it come to life. That's fantastic.
Well, I've had a marvelous time doing it, and it's a constant learning process. You know, I'm always looking at paintings from the past and depictions in every culture, you know, from the Aztecs to the Greeks, etc., and it's just fascinating to see how important that has been in human being. And you, as a culinary historian yourself, and what, to me, the great Louisiana treasure in this, of bringing us an awareness of our own immediate background. It's so important. It's a way we're linked to the past.
Patrick, I know a lot of times we walk into the shop and you're not there. You're on one of your buying trips, which I always say, please take me next time. But you know, where do you find the things that you have in your shop? And are you fairly particular about exactly where they come from, or do you have a variety of sources?
You know, I like to say that I really have no prejudices. We've had ancient Greek vessels, and I have had Mesoamerican things. But let's get down to it. Certainly, for our own time, the mother house of the culinary revolution and our culinary traditions of today really is France. So I spend a lot of time in France. It's a predisposition I have. My mother spoke French and was very much of a Francophile, and outside of Louisiana, it's the place I feel most at home.
Do you consider yourself a Francophile?
I guess I'd have to admit to that.
Do you have a dual citizenship yet, Patrick? Because it's got to be coming.
Being an Irish horse trader, I don't think the French are getting ready to give me one.
Patrick, what about your customers, not by name necessarily, or by name if you wish, but where do they come from? I mean, you know, I'm in the store often and walking around and talking to Michelle and talking to the group in there, and people are coming from all over the place, but who's the customer there?
You know, I think the customer is twofold. It's the person that does have this addiction to old things, and, you know, there is a gene pool for that that cuts across all ages. And then, of course, there are the foodies, because we have been written up a lot. And this incredible effervescence of interest in food that's really happened in the last 25 or 30 years, I was lucky enough, and it was just pure luck, to sort of begin to ride the cusp. You know, in the 1970s, lots of guys wanted to be ballet dancers. Now they all want to be chefs. And I think that the interest in food and the connection of food with the nostalgia of having rootedness and connectedness to other people as well as to our past has really developed an interest in how to serve it and how to serve it best, and maybe not always how to serve it exactly like they did in the past, but how to use some of the things of the past in the present. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've had a lot of famous customers. There's Chef Fultz that comes in from time to time. And we have a lot of chefs that come in from all over the country. And in fact, we even have sent stuff back from Europe. And a few royals have come in. So we've had Ed, but the people I love best are our neighbors, the people from around the South that come to New Orleans and enjoy everything about New Orleans. And we're just part of the experience.
Well, Patrick, it must be pretty satisfying to... I can't help but to believe that you fall in love with a lot of these pieces yourself. And I know sometimes it must be fairly hard to part with it. So finding a right home for it must be pretty satisfying in itself.
Honey, I'm glad you have romanticized my position. But, I'm always on to the next kill, so I've got to sell. The funny thing is, people, I think even the chef has said this, she said, I bet you keep the best stuff for yourself. And the only thing I ever keep are the orphans. And the less they sell, the more I fall in love with them. I guess it's an ego thing, never admitting I made a mistake. So I have a house full of orphans.
Yeah, I'd love to see your orphans.
Yeah, quite a culinary orphanage,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah, I bet.
Patrick, we were talking earlier about how we think of culinary and tableware antiques, you know, that a lot of them are made from sterling and copper and porcelain and wood. But one of the oldest and I guess overlooked materials is iron. You know, iron wasn't just for pots. There were the foragers worked it into useful tools, but they were creative in creating these pieces as well. They weren't just utilitarian pieces, but they were decorative. Can you tell us about some of those items?
First of all, one of the attractions for me of the past and of the notion of craftsmanship is that everything, whether it was a skillet or a pot hook to hang in the fireplace, it united the notion that it had to be useful, but that it ought to also be pretty. I think it is a lesson that one of the things we need to learn, and that's one of the things when I'm sitting at Revolution, I mean, I know I'm going to really love it on my taste buds, but it's pretty to look at. It's so important to unite the aesthetics with the practical. And I think it's a great heresy today that things have to be ugly to be useful. I love the old ironwork. Of course, we live in a city that loved ironwork. But some of the decorative elements in the 17th and 18th century on these cooking tools is really exceptional. I think you all have quite a few of those things. But
Patrick, I'm so attracted to the clock wand rotisseries. I'm also attracted to the pot cranes, and they're so beautiful. And every time I walk into your shop, even though I have two or three of them, there's another magnificent one on the wall that's so special, so different. Size and shape is just so attractive that it's just like, oh my God, I have to have that one for my collection, even though I dream of making sure that one day it's going to be hanging in a proper fireplace. Do people, like let's say myself, are we attracted to pieces because we collect certain things, or we're attracted at the whole genre of things, or do people ever come back and say, look, I want to swap this one out for another one? How does that whole process work in your mind?
Well, I think there's several types of collectors. I mean, they're the ones that want a sort of an example of almost every form. Then they're the ones that want the perfect thing within any form, so they're constantly wanting to trade up. I think your love of the cremeliere, the pot hook, probably goes somewhat deeper. You know, there's the French expression for housewarming gift is prendre cremeliere, bring a cremeliere. You didn't need a bed, you didn't need a chair, you didn't need a table, but to have a home, you needed a cremeliere. And there's something so fundamental about the notion of what a human being needs at the bottom that I think is the reason that those cremelieres were so pretty, because this was something that every house needed to be a home. And that's probably one of the reasons you love those things.
And also, I think often, I mean, I have a beautiful one that I got from you that's in my fireplace at home, and I built a fireplace large enough to be able to do adequate open hearth cookery with all the pieces that I've gotten from you. And but I think when I sit and watch a goose or something turn on my rotisserie in front of the fireplace, that whole scene is like being in a fabulous movie theater or on stage at a play, because I'm watching history revolve in front of me. I'm watching the flavor of the meat. I can taste it as it's roasting. But at the same time, I look past the rotisserie into this beautifully handcrafted, hand-hammered iron piece from the 1700s that I know it's mine. I know it's a piece of history. And I think to myself, what's going to happen with that piece? It's amazing what happens in your mind sitting in front of that fireplace watching food cook, but realizing the artwork that's sitting in front of your eyes that you just mesmerized by. And I don't know if most people feel that way about their pieces, but that's exactly the way I feel about it. And you bring that to me by teaching me and giving me more information about a piece, telling me a little bit about the history of it. And then people walk into my home, and immediately I have to say, let me tell you about this piece, you know, and people are fascinated by this stuff.
You know, you've hit it right on the head with, if I had to, at any level, spiritually justify what I do, just like you do, you nourish people. I do have, underneath it all, a small mission. I think it has never been more critical in our human history that people have a sense of that past and have a sense of what human beings have done since the beginning of time. And it helps make us understand what being human is about, what our purpose is on earth, and connect those things. And, you know, I have to say, of course, I'm selling the junk, so naturally I'm going to say it, but antiques do bring up those thoughts. Somebody else has used this for many times. Somebody else will use it after us. There is this continuum. And I think it really does have a spiritual dimension. I mean, you stare into a fire and you, all of those thoughts come up to you. And I'm hoping that, especially, you know, I'm trying to find my younger victims here, that I can teach that. I'm hoping that the children that are growing up with this all of a sudden understand that it's more than just going to the suburbs and seeing transitory things, that there are eternal truths. And that these things will help us sort of come to that.
No, so well put, absolutely.
Very well put. That was beautiful, Patrick. I'm kind of looking at the clock here and wondering if you could devote a few more minutes to us. We need to take a break, Patrick, but could you hold on for just a few minutes and we'll come back and finish up our conversation because we still have questions.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, y'all, we're going to be back in just a minute. You don't want to go anywhere. The best is yet to come.
While we lay there by the juniper, while the moon is bright, watching those jugs are filling in the pale
moonlight. Bugalú legend Joe Cuba was a leader in the Latin soul movement in New York. The hits, the storytelling, this guy was very cool. Hello, I'm Georges Codinet. Join me this week as we celebrate Joe Cuba on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Hi, this is Bill Bowens from The Dirty Rice Show, inviting you to join either Mr. Lee Klein, Peter, or myself every Saturday night from 8:30 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Dirty Rice right here on KRBS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, Public Radio for Acadiana.
Konnichiwa, this is Emily with Rock Japan, inviting you to join me late night Fridays at 3 a.m. and Mondays at 11 p.m. here on KRVS 88.7 FM. We'll explore the new, old, and experimental music of the island nation of Japan and how they rock the world from dusk till the rising sun.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, now broadcasting in HD radio technology.
Here we go. I got one pot, a metal spoon. What do you got? You got a rhythm tune. You got a pot, spoon, rhythm tune. You got a pot, a spoon, and rhythm tune. Got a little, got a lot, got a musical pot. Now what? Now what? I got pots, pots and pans. I got pots. Pots and pans, yeah, that's the way that I like to play. Banging on pots and pans, yeah. Banging on pots and pans.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. It's so nice to have you back with us. And, Michelle, we have to mention our Facebook page. We appreciate people sending in your recipes and your favorite dish because we want you to be a guest right here on Stirring It Up. Michelle, talking about a guest, we have our great friend Patrick Dunn from Lucullus Antiques in New Orleans, right on Charter Street. And a couple of weeks ago, we had Molly Wismire, you remember?
Yeah.
Restaurant Revolution on the program to discuss champagne. And the champagne glass shape has its own story. Patrick, can you tell us a little bit? Molly was in your store with me the other day, and we were looking at champagne glasses, and she was like going absolutely wild. You have such a great collection of crystal and wine glasses and champagne glasses and water glasses. Tell us a little bit about the evolution of the glass in your shop.
You know, champagne was basically invented at the end of the 17th century by the blind monk, Dom Perignon. That's the tradition, at least. And I think that they probably took to drinking it in whatever glass they had available that wasn't too open-mouthed. So I think they probably borrowed a Venetian glass that might have just been hanging around since Louis XIV's mother was Italian. And that was certainly the tradition of drinking champagne was in a flute, which, you know, quickly in the 18th century and then in the 19th century developed. But somewhere in there, it must have been some edgy hostess, had a coupe-shaped glass, and she started serving champagne in it. When you read, especially English books, glass books on why the coupe was used, most of them, who of course, the English were notoriously anti-French, claimed that it was a kinky development from the days of Marie Antoinette, and that the champagne coupe had originally been molded on the bosom of Marie Antoinette, and that in these wild orgies at Versailles, they were drinking out of these coupes. I think that was a totally anti-Francophile view, because what in fact happened was they discovered a beautiful Sèvres porcelain set that did have forms from the female anatomy, which were great reproductions of a Greek cup that they had found. And I think that's where this rumor got started. Interestingly enough, everybody wanted to drink champagne out of a flute up until the last year or so, and more were having people want to do the coupe. So I guess it's the swing of the pendulum.
Yeah,
I'm still a flute man.
Yeah, and I'm a flute man myself. Patrick, you walk into your shop, you walk into Lucullus, and you look around, and there's so many areas to search. I mean, there's furniture, there's serving pieces, there's artwork, there's porcelain of every type, there's ironwork, there's copper. For those in our audience looking to begin their career in culinary antique collection, where do you recommend that they begin when they come to your shop? Where do you direct someone who wants to buy that first piece and then become a collector?
Chef, you know what I always want? I always ask the question, what are you interested in? That's the thing. I mean, because everybody has their particular slant. Are you interested in wine? Well, steal an old wine glass. I know everybody, there's so many expensive and great wine glasses out there, but steal an old one. Feel the weight of it. Feel the substantiality of it, if that's what you're interested in. Or for the cook that really doesn't care so much about the table but really wants to stir up a good pot, feel an old copper pot that's been re-tinned. That's the way for me to get started. And then one thing always leads to the other. You get a pretty glass, then you want a nice big fork and spoon, then you want an old plate. And then hopefully it just rolls right along.
You know, Patrick, you've recommended a couple of your clients who have become clients of ours now, whether we're catering something in their home or doing a special function for them. And in getting to know these individuals, we've learned about your decorating services, because not only are you providing antiques, but you are helping them to create the entire kitchen and dining setting. But this isn't something new that you've been doing this for a long time. Can you tell us about some of these projects? I know you've had some really interesting ones.
Well, thank you for, you know, mentioning that. And let me just say this. One of the reasons that I've connected some of our clients with you all is because I feel like we have the same perspective. And again, it goes back to showing people that the past is alive and vibrant, and using antiques in their house are beautiful and function. I don't know why people think that antiques have to be formal, stiff, uncomfortable, and unhospitable. In fact, it's quite the opposite. They evoke all of the notions of hospitality. We've been lucky enough to work on quite a few historic projects in the Garden District up on Audubon Place. I've worked on two plantations, one right here in the city of New Orleans, and then one out in the country at Cretien Point, which has been one of the great experiences of my life. Believe it or not, I'm dying to get some person to ask me to do a modern loft apartment in the CBD, but I must look too old and curmudgeonry to get that offer.
Well, hopefully somebody's listening right now that's saying, oh, my God, I have to get to Patrick Dunn. And one last question, Patrick, and then we'll let you go back to work. We know you have a line outside probably. And I know this is kind of an open-ended question, but I just absolutely not only love what you do, I love your quality, I love your perspective, I absolutely love the diversity of the pieces you provide to us, and your passion for it all, and you're a hell of a good friend too at the same time. But to answer one simple question for our audience, why should people be interested in collecting culinary antiques?
Well, I think it's a bigger question, and I would throw it back to you. Why should people be interested in eating the food of traditional Louisiana, no matter how contemporary a spin you put on it? And I think the answer goes back to the theme that we've discussed throughout this program. And, you know, it's my really firm belief that a land without a past is a land without history, and a land without history is a wasteland. And we have got to connect the dots. We have to connect it so that we can survive, but we have to connect it because it enriches us. It enriches, you know, our soul. I think you and I both share the notion that man does have this profound spiritual dimension. And all of these things of the world, the beautiful things, the nourishing things, are things that really bring him closer to developing that soul. And that's the reason.
Now, that's a beautiful way to put it. And you know, I've always said, I tell my students at Nickel State and my young chefs all the time, they say, you know, can cuisine evolve? Does cultures evolve? Well, of course they do. But I always say that food and cultures cannot evolve unless there's a huge respect for where you're coming from, the ingredients that you're familiar with, how do you cook them, and how do you put them on a plate, and how do you serve them, and how do you wow your guests with the beauty of the foods of an area. So I want to encourage our listeners now to go to our website, jfalls.com, and go to Stirring It Up, the radio show, and there you're going to find all of the information on Lucullus. You're going to find all of the information on the address, Patrick's information. And I encourage you, if nothing else, stop by the shop, even if you're not a collector, to just kind of browse through the beauty of ages past. And I guarantee you, you will find something that will turn you on to collecting. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us today. And again, more importantly, thanks for just being a good friend and an associate of ours.
Well, thank you for having me. And Michelle, tell the chef I have some new things for him.
Will do.
I was in there just the other day. You don't need to entice me. I'm coming. Love you, Patrick. Love
day.
You, Patrick. Thank you so much. Okay, y'all. Bye. That was fantastic. So, Michelle, what about any books on the subject? I know I see you have a couple of them in your hand.
Well, absolutely. First of all, The Epicurean Collector, of course. This is Patrick Dunn's book that he did with the editors of Southern Accents magazine. It's a beautiful compilation of culinary antiques, and they tell the story of these antiques' relation to food evolution through the centuries. Beautiful, gorgeous photographs, and great history. No recipes. This is just strictly culinary antique information. And then the second book that we have for you, Refined American Cuisine, The Inn at Little Washington, which I know is one of your favorite places. This is by Patrick O'Connell. We like to say that fine culinary antiques require refined cuisine as well. In the book, you'll find recipes for dishes with caviar and truffles, but to macaroni and cheese with Virginia country ham. The dish presentations are beautiful. The photographs are gorgeous. And the author's reminiscences of family entertaining traditions will be quite entertaining and have you laughing in the kitchen. But both are great additions to the culinary library. We'll have the information on our website, jfols.com.
All right, good. And before I give a recipe, Michelle, how's our boucherie dinner coming together at Revolution?
Well, you know, it's tomorrow night. Be one or two spots left. Chop.
Yep, so people need to jump on it, huh?
They need to call Revolution immediately to make that reservation.
That's in New Orleans. And, y'all, it's a full boucherie dinner, the first annual Revolution boucherie dinner. We're going to begin with charcuterie courses just passed around the dining room. And only 50 people can attend, and I think we're pretty close to that right now.
The dinner's February 24th. I know that some of our listeners listen different days of the week. So I said tomorrow, February 24th, is the date of the event.
And then we're going to have a full, I think, 5 or 6 course dinner where all of the items will revolve around pork and the pigs that we have raised. And this is just paying homage to the boucherie. So, Michelle, I wanted to create a dish that would allow me to use those beautiful oyster plates we have. You know those beautiful?
You have
a couple oyster plates?
I have some oyster plates. I sure do. They're gorgeous.
And there's places in the Quarter, and especially Lucullus, where you can get these beautiful oyster plates, 6 or a dozen porcelain plates. I mean, you can get the 6 holes or the half dozen. Well, y'all, I want to do Oysters Rockefeller Premiere. This is the beautiful, beautiful Rockefeller dish that we do at the restaurant. And people are always asking me, especially in oyster season like we're in right now, about Oysters Rockefeller. So Premiere in French, of course, means to come first. So this is a version of an oyster dish that was first created at Antoine's restaurant in New Orleans by Jules Alcitor, if you remember. And by serving the dish in these oyster plates, you create this rich, beautiful look at the beginning of a dinner. I begin with 4 dozen fresh shucked oysters with liquid, and that's important. You should always ask your fishmonger or your oyster shucker, or shuck them yourself, and strain the liquid through a sieve and make sure you're saving that oyster juice. It's pure oyster essence. I always begin with 3 10-ounce packages of frozen chopped spinach from the store. You can do it fresh, but the chopped works really well. And then into a large saute pan, once I have taken the oysters and made sure I had no shells, and then kind of made sure I reserved all of the liquid, I put the oysters in a pan with the juice and just heat them up until the oysters are firm and the edges start to curl a little bit. I drain them, reserve the liquid. I set the oysters aside to cool, and then I go ahead and kind of chop them up coarsely. I'll save 12 oysters whole to put in the shell, but I make sure I chop up a lot of oysters down in there to give it that great oyster flavor. I go ahead and I thaw out the spinach. I drain it, set it aside, and then in a big 10-12-inch skillet, I melt 3 sticks of butter. That's a lot of butter, it seems like, but of course, this is going to serve 12 people, and the butter really makes the difference here. You can cut it back a little bit if you wish. I'm going to go ahead and melt the butter over medium-high heat, and then I'm going to add a teaspoon of thyme, 1 2/3 cup of chopped green onions, 1 cup of chopped celery, 1 large clove of garlic that's crushed and chopped, and I'm going to just saute that around for just a minute. Then I'm going to add the chopped spinach to it. I'm going to saute all of that around, the thyme, the green onions, the celery, the garlic, along with the spinach, and kind of mix it all together. That's going to be about a 5-7 minute saute. Then into that, I'm going to add a tablespoon of Worcestershire sauce, 1 teaspoon of anchovy paste. In old days, they used to mash fresh anchovies. You can get anchovy paste, or you can leave it out if you're not liking anchovies that much. 2 tablespoons of anise liqueur, or Pernod, or herb saint would go into it right then, mixed into the spinach, and oysters would all be sauteing beautifully there. And then you want to add just enough breadcrumbs to the skillet to kind of suck up the water, but make sure that you're not making it too dry or too bready. That's the most important thing. You want it to be juicy, but you need those seasoned Italian breadcrumbs in there. Then you remove it from the heat and you add 1/2 cup of grated Parmesan cheese to it, and then you season that spinach mixture with salt, pepper, granulated garlic, a little cayenne if you want to. And once it's seasoned really nice and the breadcrumbs have kind of picked up all the liquid but it's still moist, then you're going to put an oyster in each one of the shells, and then you're going to top it with that beautiful bright green spinach oyster filled flavored mixture. Just kind of round it off on the top of the shells, and you're going to bake it at 375 degrees for about 20 to 25 minutes until the top of the oysters, the spinach is browning, a little bubbling going on in the dish. And then you're going to serve about 6 of them per person. You know, you want to kind of get some of those oysters out there in front of them. Anyway, y'all, the recipe's on the website, jfalls.com. Just go to radio show and it's all right there. Please go visit our good friend Patrick Dunn at Lucullus. It is vision that will just be so beautiful on your eyes. And y'all, be safe. Cook those oysters. See you next week.